Oh, good evening. And I might mention again, for those of you who came in a little bit late, that if you're here to listen to Joel, a fellow from Oregon, give a talk, I believe he's speaking in the building that's in the front, and rather than here. So just so in case there's some confusion. So this evening, I wanted to talk, in a sense, carrying forward with the some of the basic introductory themes of the beginning course. I want to talk about what can be called the grammar of mindfulness meditation, or the grammar of meditation. I think 2 weeks ago, Carolyn Dilley talked about the five hindrances. The five hindrances being those five more common forces of the mind, preoccupations of the mind, where that takes us away from being present, makes it difficult for us to be present. And it's very important in mindfulness not to get discouraged by the mind's tendency to get lost and preoccupied by different things, but rather than getting discouraged, to actually get to learn really well the various ways in which we have of getting lost in our thoughts or lost in our feelings. So if we get to know these things really well, then our awareness becomes stronger, our sense of presence becomes stronger than the power of distraction, and we can learn to live a more undistracted life. And as Carolyn talked about, I suppose, there are five hindrances, five of these forces that distract us quite a bit, and most likely places that have greatest power. And these are called desire, aversion, or ill will, restlessness and anxiety, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And so part of what happens in a mindfulness practice is really getting to know these well, becoming kind of experts at what's called the hindrances. Not to treat them as enemies or as problems, but as places where we're strengthening our ability to become present and be aware in an undistracted way. Now today's theme is another list of five, and some of you, as you learn more about Buddhism, will learn that Buddhism has many lists. It's one of its, some people call virtues, and some people call whatever. But has many lists. Partly, I think, it's because they didn't have written texts, they didn't write down the teachings back in the time of the Buddha. So in order to help people remember the teachings and the instructions, if it was given numerically in lists, it was a lot easier to remember. It's a mnemonic device. So today's topic is what's called the five faculties, the five mental capacities or mental functions, which form kind of the grammar that or the structure or the pieces of that come into play as we become, as we meditate. And these five faculties, these five potentials or powers or abilities we have within us, we have to tap into these abilities, these five abilities, and let them start becoming stronger. And not only stronger, but also balanced. Now these five abilities that we all have are faith or trust, energy or perseverance or engagement, mindfulness or presence, concentration or sustaining our attention on what we're paying attention to, and then the fifth one is wisdom or insight, or penetratingly seeing actually what's going on each moment by moment. So faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And these are five abilities we have, and when they become quite strong and quite balanced, they're very important factors contributing to the liberation that Buddhism talks about, the liberation of what probably is best translated into English is the liberation of the heart. There's this wonderful word in Pali, in Buddhist language, in Pali and Sanskrit, called citta, C-I-T-T-A, which often is translated as mind, but it's probably much better translated into English as heart. And in the ancient world, in ancient India, they all thought that the seat of thinking was in the heart, and they'd point here, not up in the brain. And they didn't distinguish so sharply as perhaps we do between what's heart, what we call what's the aspects of our heart, and what goes on in our thoughts and our mind. And So the citta, this mind that's in our heart, is very akin, maybe, to the English expression to put your heart into something, or to give a heartfelt response to someone. We have various words that refer to the heart, which have to do with which qualities of cognition, of recognition, of mind, of thinking, of communication. But when we use the word heartfelt or of the heart's deepest desire, I think we're referring to something that's not just simply rational or intellectual, but something that's also connected, but not separate from that, but something that's also connected to our emotional center, emotional being. And this word citta is a sense of who we are, the core of who we are, in a sense. That's the combination, the balance of our emotional side and our intellectual side, our side of perhaps reason and the side of feeling. And citta includes both of them. And what's very nice, I think, about these five abilities, or five faculties of mind, is they represent five different areas of our inner life that need to come into balance. And many of us tend to be imbalanced one way or the other. So faith is often much more associated with, maybe we could say, the heart center of who we are. Faith, unless it's blind belief, and you're believing some certain tenets. Faith has a certain kind of emotional tone to it, or feeling tone, your kind of trustworthiness or confidence, inspiration are closely connected to faith. And wisdom, for most of us, is more connected to the intellect, the ideas and understanding. And the way that these lists, the five faculties, are set up is number one, number five, faith and wisdom, are opposites in the sense that they're supposed to be balance each other. You need to have both of them. And also for number two and number four, energy and concentration need to be balanced. To have one of them out of balance is to create an imbalanced citta, an imbalanced kind of a center of who we are, an imbalanced kind of presence. If there's too much faith and not enough understanding or wisdom, then it can be blind faith. Or you're just kind of believing blindly whatever you're told or whatever. Or it can be just a lot of emotional kind of outpouring of inspiration, but it's not really connected to real understanding about what the object of faith is. And so again, it can be kind of blind and maybe devotional in a kind of perhaps even dangerous way. And wisdom or insight, when it occurs without faith, without trust or inspiration or confidence, that it can be kind of dry and empty. It can just be ideas. It can be book knowledge or just blind. You might have very deep penetrating seeing and stuff, but it's not connected to any sense of inspiration or any kind of heartfelt qualities. And so it's kind of aloof and distant. So these two qualities both need to be there. There needs to be the kind of the insight, the intellectual side of understanding. And there needs to be the heartfelt kind of feelings of faith or confidence, inspiration. But they need to be there together to balance each other so they kind of correct each of the shortcomings of each other. Faith is a beautiful word, I think. However, here in the West, it's a problematic word for many people. I think a lot of people who have come to mindfulness meditation or Buddhist meditation often come somewhat with a history of some kind of connection to Western faith that disappointed them. Not so much maybe necessarily with the object of faith, but just the fact that they kind of threw themselves in maybe a little bit blindly, or maybe they were asked to believe things blindly without kind of testing it or really knowing for oneself. But faith, I think, the word faith, sadda, that we translate as faith or confidence, trust, is interesting to me that in the root of the word, the ancient India, the word meant hospitality. So the idea, Buddhist idea of faith has some quality of being hospitable to something. And I think it works very well for mindfulness practice. What we're trying to do is to open our awareness to all our life, our inner life and life of the world around us, with some feeling of hospitality to what's going on around us, some being a host to this world and to our experience, to ourselves. to be host to ourselves and to our friends, rather than walking into a situation and being automatically defensive or automatically kind of aggressive or afraid or ambitious or desirous or confused or whatever, but rather come into a situation with some basic feeling of goodwill and being a host to experience that in a healthy way. A host is someone who perhaps is willing to allow things to be, allow the guest to be as the guest is, and not to interfere or kind of make the guest different, but also to make the guest somewhat comfortable, but not to let the guest kind of stay forever either. So this faith has this quality of kind of being hospitable to experience, but not holding on to anything. One of the great problems, I think, around faith is when we grasp and become attached to something. And holding on, not letting things leave when it's their time to leave, is considered to be a source of tremendous suffering, at least in the Buddhist analysis of suffering. So to be open to experience, to have the kind of confidence or the inner trust, to be open to experience what's going on, neither pushing your way or grasping onto it, is part of the function of faith. Part of faith is to have trust in oneself, have some confidence in one's own abilities, one's own faculties, to begin to unravel the entanglements of suffering that cause a lot of difficulty for us, that cause suffering, cause pain and distress. Part of the Buddhist offering as a spiritual practice is not to offer some kind of, hopefully not to offer some kind of abstract metaphysical or spiritual beliefs that you have to believe in, but rather to say, look, there's problems with our life. You'll find most of us will have some level of stress, of suffering, of existential anxiety, of fear about something. Most people have some elements of these kinds of things in them. And most of it's because of these forms of fear or distress or suffering or something, feeling of inadequacy or insecurity or whatever, that often is a source for spiritual yearning and longing. And maybe not always, but oftentimes. And spiritual longing and yearning, because it's kind of leaning forward for something out there, looking for something that's going to do it, that's going to provide the answer, it's very easy to kind of look too much outside. The answer's going to be outside of yourself. What Buddhism wants to do is to take a mirror, a gentle, compassionate mirror, and turn that yearning or that longing, that desire for some kind of peace or calm or love or compassion or whatever, and turn it back on yourself so you can find what you're looking for inside yourself rather than finding it in a belief outside or some kind of something outside of yourself. There's always the idea of turning the mirror back. And part of the function of faith as one of the five faculties is to have some confidence in your own abilities to turn that mirror of awareness back. And then to have the skills to be able to begin to understand how we contribute to our stress, our longing, our existential anxiety, or the very thing, the kind of irritation or the kind of annoyance or the kind of unsatisfactory feeling that is often part of our life. Buddhism is the antidote or the solution, Buddhist practice, to all forms of distress or dissatisfaction that we contribute to the situation by our attachments and our aversions. So this gentle kind of compassionate mirror that says, look back, and you have within yourself the skills and the tools. And to have some confidence in your own ability is necessary in order to do a kind of meditation practice. To have some kind of faith or confidence. Now it's said often in Buddhist texts that it's not so easy to have this kind of confidence in oneself when one starts a meditation practice, or when one starts a spiritual practice. And initially, the sense of trust in the practice maybe is a kind of borrowed trust. In the same sense, you know, if you're going to take a class in what? In singing. And you're going to sign up for the adult extension at Stanford, and you're going to sign up for a singing class. You have some trust that the university is going to provide you with someone who's a competent singer and trained to teach singing. if you're going to take that class. You have that kind of trust there. And then you show up there for that class, and the teacher says, okay, give me an A, whatever. I don't know anything about singing, so I'm just making this up. Don't come to me for singing lessons. Or the teacher gives you this piece and says, okay, I want everybody to sing this so I can hear what it's like. And so everybody sings it, and the teacher says, well, try doing this with your voice, whatever. So, oh, okay, I'll try this. And you don't have a clue whether this person, you know, knows anything about singing. But because you signed up, and because of Stanford, and because you paid all this money, or whatever, you invest a certain amount of trust in this person. This person probably, you know, knows something about singing and can lead you to some place that'd be useful. But it better lead someplace pretty quickly to find it useful. Otherwise, if you don't verify for yourself that there's something to, you know, that to your ability to develop your singing, then you better, you know, find another teacher. Does it make sense what I'm saying? So initially, there's kind of borrowed faith, where you meet someone, maybe a friend who's a meditator or a teacher or anybody who kind of is involved in the spiritual practice, and there's something about them that gives you some confidence that, yeah, I think I can check this out. I'll try it out. But I'm not going to depend on that person forever. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to have to find out for myself whether this is really the case, but I'll trust this person long enough to take this class, or trust this person long enough to try it for a few months, something like that. So there is this element of trust, which is kind of matter of fact. We do it in our culture all the time, which the Buddhist text talks about is very important for beginning a meditation practice. So trust is very important. It's also deeply connected to the idea of inspiration, to be inspired. And we can be inspired by someone else we know who maybe is a practitioner. We can be inspired by reading a text. Or we can be inspired by something really deeply knowable in ourselves. Many of us have had some kind of experience where we feel some tremendous sense of well-being or compassion or connectedness with the world and with ourselves, some kind of deep peace. And we know that, this is a capacity and ability that I have, is to be in this world in a loving, friendly, hospitable way. And we can take inspiration in that. Oh, yeah. This is really inspiring. This is a capacity of myself. And I'm going to, you know, move into the spiritual practice by that inspiration. And inspiration is very dangerous because it's closely connected to expectation. And when there's expectation, then it's often a setup for spiritual disaster in meditation. Because if we expect something to happen, one of the things we learn when we do a meditation practice is that nothing stays the same. And expectation usually has this quality that you expect something, a thing. And because you expect it, you kind of expect it to stay around for a while. Or you expect that you can get it today or tomorrow. But it doesn't work that way so well in meditation. It isn't like a thing we're getting. So expectation is a little bit dangerous. So, faith is an important quality. The faith and inspiration, naturally, I think, lends itself to energy, to engagement, to wanting to kind of do the practice. You know, if you sit, you can sit at home and read books about spirituality forever, I suppose. I've known people who've read books for 20 years, and then they come and they say, you know, I've been reading books about Buddhism for 20 years, it really felt right, and for some reason I never actually put it to practice, but finally, here I am. So it took 20 years for the energy to build up to a level that they were ready. But enough faith or trust or inspiration leads to wanting to do something, to be engaged, to actually not just sit and read, but actually to do something, put it into practice. And you don't have a spiritual practice unless there's the energy there, the effort or the engagement in doing something. So now effort, again, is actually a very beautiful part of who we are, the engagement, to actually bring our effort in our to pay attention, to be attentive, to be concentrated, to be present, to be compassionate, to bring engaged effort, I think is one of the beautiful things we have, provided it's not tinged with expectation, provided it's not tinged with a striving and straining and demanding or wanting, expecting things to be a certain way. But actually, you know, it's kind of like maybe some of you have a hobby that you do. And, you know, and you just love kind of coming home and just kind of really putting yourself into your hobby, and time goes really fast. I remember it was someone on Sunday, it was Father's Day, right? And it was one of the cartoons, on Sunday cartoons, I forget who it was, All in the Family, is that what the one? Where the father was in the garage, kind of organizing all his tools in the garage, in the workspace, and his kids and his wife come out and say, it's Father's Day, we're taking you to the movies to celebrate and let you relax. And he said, oh great, that's so nice. And so they take him to the movies, and he's sitting there in the movie seat, I guess about to watch the movie, and his mind wanders off back into the garage to his workspace, organizing the tools. That's what he really wanted to do on his Father's Day. But he was being, you know, kind to his family. So we can do things, and it brings us tremendous joy to do certain things. If there isn't the striving, the expectation, or the measuring ourselves, are we doing it good enough, or how am I doing it compared to someone else, or but just doing it for its own sake. But there has to be some kind of doing. And part of the art of the meditation practice is discovering what this appropriate quality of energy, of effort, of engagement in the practice. Not to try too hard, not to strain and push and be demanding in the effort, but not to be too complacent either, or too laid back and kind of, whatever is happening is fine, I'm just going to lay back, and if I spend the next half an hour just kind of zoned out, that's fine. Everything's fine in meditation practice. There's a way in which everything is fine when you meditate. Anything's acceptable, in a sense. But you don't want to be kind of spaced out. Anything's okay if you're present for it, if you're aware of what's going on. The compassionate kind of acceptance of meditation is if you're aware of whatever's going on. You're not kind of allowing all things to be whatever way they want to be and being spaced out or unaware of it. But rather, the difference is the beautiful kind of definition of mindfulness is to allow all things to be just the way they are. That's to be the host. Allow all things to be the way they are while being clearly aware of what's happening. That's really the key. If there's not the awareness, then it's actually going to be a little bit dangerous to let all things be as they are. The point is there has to be some engagement, some effort, some doing it. Not just simply in bringing yourself to the meditation session, but also once you're here, to make the effort to keep coming back, to bring yourself to the breath initially as a foundation, with an anchor, to connect yourself to the present, to be with the breath, and then to sustain the attention on the breath. The mind wanders off, which is normal. It's going to do that for sure. Then not beating yourself up or getting discouraged, but very softly and lovingly, in a sense, bring your attention back to the breath. And make the effort to come back. Make the effort to come back so that the effort factor, the effort ability we have, becomes stronger and more polished, more refined, so that with time you can make a more, you can stay and maintain a sustained effort in the present moment in a relaxed way. Like when you're doing your hobby, hopefully you're somewhat relaxed doing it, but you're also making the effort. So you're making a sustained effort through time so you can stay in the present moment. So there can be sustained presence in the present. So to really connect, to really actually, when you're sitting, for example, to sit down to really begin your meditation practice, to really make the effort, in a sense, to connect to the breath, to really connect. This is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to do this casually or, you know, haphazardly or whatever. I mean, really, this is kind of matter-of-factly. The kind of the analogy I like is, maybe it's a good analogy, is shaking someone's hand. I think there's kind of a range of ways someone can shake your hand. You've perhaps had the experience of someone just really grabbing your hand, and afterwards you have to go and get your hand adjusted. You know, just it's really squeezed down really hard, and it's just like, gee. You know, it's just like there's too much presence, too much effort there. And then there's other times, like, you know, you go to some kind of social function, there's a lot of people milling about, and someone says, oh, Gil, it's nice to see you. And they're going to shake my hand. And then kind of just when I'm going to grab their hand, they're all, hey, Joe. And I get this kind of completely limp kind of thing, you know, there's nothing there. Or maybe a better analogy is we know what it's like when a friend is really present for us. You know, they're present for you, not overbearing and kind of hanging on top of you, But also they're not kind of absent either, absent-minded. They're really present. You feel your friend's real presence. The energy, the effort of meditation is to bring that kind of friendly presence. You're really there for yourself. But it's not demanding, it's not forceful, it's not judgmental, it's not, and it's also not kind of too laid back. But there's a relaxed quality to it, in the same way that perhaps doing your hobby is a relaxed quality to your hobby, depending, I guess, what you do. Anyway. So effort. Now, the effort is balanced with concentration, or tranquility, or calmness, which is the fourth factor. So we have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So the second and fourth, because they're on opposite sides of mindfulness, they get balanced. So one of the ways, if you have a lot of energy, you don't necessarily have to, not always have to back off the energy, but you have to increase the level of your concentration to match it. And concentration is really sustaining your attention in the present moment, or learning to be comfortable and resting your presence, resting yourself in the current present. Sustaining yourself here. You know, the mind wanders away, it gets involved in all kinds of things, the mind is scattered. But to bring the mind, bring the heart, bring all the different fragmented parts of who we are together on the present moment. I think especially at the end of a busy day, many of us can feel how we're so fragmented, how our mind is going off in maybe two or three different directions at once. One of the fascinating things about meditation practice is this thing about the fragmented mind, how it gets fragmented so easily. One of the fragmentations is the fragmentation between our thoughts, our mind, in a sense, and our body. I've had the experience of going along and saying, well, you know, I'm feeling pretty good today, I'm basically kind of happy, I'm pretty relaxed, and you know, I don't think I really need to meditate this afternoon, you know, I'll just kind of continue what I'm doing. But then I'll go meditate anyway. And the body is much more honest than my mind. And so as soon as I sit down, oh, wait a minute, I wasn't so relaxed as I thought. My shoulders are kind of tense, there's kind of this energy kind of bubbling up inside of me. Oh, I was so much in my thoughts and my ideas of things that I wasn't really checking in deep inside within myself. And so the mind sometimes fools us. And sometimes just taking the moment to sit down, close your eyes and just check in, be with your body, it's a tremendous truth teller to say what's going on. And you can feel sometimes the different directions the energy is going. But once we start feeling ourselves in our body, then there's a chance for the mind and the body to start becoming united, to be unified. Concentration is often a synonym of unification of mind, body, heart, intention. So that what we're trying to do with our energy is the intention we have to be present is not in cross purposes with other kind of thoughts and ideas and everything else we're trying to do, but rather our presence is really established in our body and our mind, our hearts and our feelings. So it's all here happening together at once. And this takes some time to let that settling to happen, to let the fragmented pieces kind of settle down. And a lot of what mindfulness is in the first 15, 20 minutes of maybe a session is simply allowing, and the operating word is allowing all these parts of who we are, the fragmented parts, to kind of settle on their own. We try to bring our attention, we try to make the effort to be with our breath, but we don't really, it's really important not to be disturbed or concerned too much about all the ways in which your mind kind of goes off and gets wandered and all the feelings and thoughts and ideas that come up. But rather to keep coming back to the breath in a soft way and allow all these things to do what they need to do without your involvement, without getting hooked by them. The mind, you know, you start thinking about what happened today at work and, you know, someone said something to you and then you remember this during meditation. And it makes you angry. How could that person have said that? So you just allow the anger to be there, as opposed to saying, well, now that I'm angry, what am I going to tell them tomorrow? What's a really good thing to say back? Or who else should I go talk to? And if I tell them that, then I have to go and maybe do this and that and this and that. And then we're kind of low with some train of thought. But simply allow it to be there, allow that thought to be there, allow that anger to be there, and not to get involved. But in the first 20 minutes maybe of a sitting, and especially in the afternoon, it's a lot of it just settling, allowing all these pieces to settle themselves. But as we do that, we're kind of bringing together, unifying in a sense, our body, our mind, our awareness, our intention, so we're not at cross purposes with ourselves. So we can maintain and sustain some attention, some effort to be present through time. And as I said before we started sitting, there are two things to the sitting practice. There's connecting to the object of meditation, connecting to the breath, and then there's a sustaining of that attention through time, which is the concentration part. There's the effort to be mindful of something in the present moment, and then there's the effort, and that effort also involves sustaining that mindfulness through time. But it's very important that the effort to sustain the attention is not demanding or expecting anything, or straining, or holding on, or all these things, because then you'll get disappointed. Because inevitably, if you're the one who's trying to get concentrated, if you're the one who's trying to get mindful, as if you have, you know, some kind of, you know, if you feel like you're too much in charge of your meditation practice, then you're asking for trouble. Meditation is this really strange phenomena where you're both supposed to be kind of in charge and not in charge at the same time. You're supposed to you have to make the effort. No one's going to do it for you. You have to make the effort to kind of be present, come back to your breath, come back to your different, whatever's happening in the present moment. To effort to be mindful. But your ability to develop that mindfulness through time, your ability to develop concentration as you do that, that is not your doing. That's something that happens kind of on its own, but because you just keep bringing the attention back, bringing your attention back. That makes sense somehow? So it's both kind of, you're both in charge, you're not in charge. So don't take responsibility too much. And if you don't take too much responsibility, then you can't take too much blame either for how it's going. You can't say, oh my God, you know, I'm not doing it well enough, or I'm not succeeding, or whatever. We just kind of matter-of-factly continue to make the effort to be mindful. So there's the inspiration, the faith, there's the engagement or the effort, and then the fourth one is there's the concentration, or really sustaining the effort, really. And then there's the fifth one is insight or wisdom. And part of this is when we learn to be in the present moment and accept the present moment as it is, to be host to the present moment, not trying to make the present moment any different than what it is, allowing us to sit here with our depression or our sadness or our joy or headache or body pains or whatever, just sit here and find that equanimity, find that acceptance, allow yourself to be with it mindfully. Then not to change it, not to make it go away, or not to kind of get anything. The insight part of this practice is to actually to look deeper. Once we kind of have more or less kind of accepted things as they are, as in this, you know, kind of whatever our experience is in the present, the insight part of mindfulness is to use the mindfulness and the concentration to begin looking closer. What is this experience I'm having right now? If I look closer at it, and if I turn the mirror more closely back and move, so if you have a physical sensation in your body, some physical pain, to look more closely at it. What is this? You know, have you ever really carefully looked at a physical pain in your life? Have you ever kind of really studied your headache? Not, you know, try to get rid of it or blame it or have self-pity about it or all these things, but really get curious about a headache. And, you know, can you find where in the head is it? Can you localize it? What happens when you get really close to it? Or you have some strong emotion. So the initial part of practice is just to kind of be the host to it. Oh, I'm having a strong emotion. It's difficult to be with. Granted that, but I'll just keep bringing my mindfulness to it and notice my aversion or my clinging, but I'll just try to be with it. But once you can kind of be with it, once you kind of have some modicum of acceptance of it, some modicum of being a host to it, then the insight part is to really look at it more carefully. What is the experience of being, you know, depressed? Can you really look into it? You know, where in your, what happens in your body when you're depressed? Is there kind of a suppression or kind of dropping of energy somewhere? Or a kind of void or kind of feeling of emptiness somewhere in your body? Is there feeling a block anywhere? To kind of go in and kind of explore what is going on when depression is there. Cognitively, what are the thoughts and ideas that go through your mind as you're depressed? Are there certain kind of stories you keep telling yourself over and over again when there's depression? To kind of investigate. But the investigation is not, again, striving or demanding or expecting anything, but it's kind of a loving kind of, let me try to get to know this better. Just kind of let me look better. As we do this, so these are the four aspects. Now the middle function of the five abilities is mindfulness itself. And maybe I don't have to talk about it especially. I've talked about it in the context of all the other four. But mindfulness is just very, very simple. It's simply recognizing what's going on in the present moment. So if we have some kind of trust in the present moment, some kind of inspiration that being in the present moment is useful, if we have some kind of engagement to try to come back and be in the present moment, if we can sustain that ability to be in the present moment through time, if we can investigate what's happening in the present moment, it's all a servant to our ability to really recognize what's going on in the present moment. Not just simply to be present, but to, in a loving way, to recognize what is actually happening here in the present moment. As we do this kind of, as the insight, as the wisdom part of the practice gets stronger, we realize that our presence or our awareness, our ability to recognize, this ability we have, is different than all the things that we pay attention to. So there can be anger or depression or physical pain or chaos around us, but the knowing faculty, the faculty of being present, begins to become stronger and becomes, in a sense, kind of a refuge or kind of a strength or a resource, so that whenever we feel that things are going terrible in our life, we don't necessarily have to look outside of ourselves for some kind of balance, but we have it within ourselves simply by returning to our mindfulness, returning to our ability to be present, to be aware. So it's said in Buddhism that when these five abilities we have are developed through practice, they become five powers or five strengths that we have. And then they become strengths that we can carry with us into our life, and they can serve us greatly. So one of the things, one of the reasons to talk about this to relatively new students of meditation, or at least following the introductory course, is that it's possible to use this knowledge to kind of to study where are the imbalances in your meditation practice in the present moment. You know, what's happening now with your energy? What kind of energy do you have? Is it too much? Is it too little? Is it energy, is it kind of agitated or scattered? Or does it need to be balanced with some concentration or some tranquility? If you find yourself with a tremendous amount of agitated energy, then the best thing to do, one of the great things to do, is to balance that with concentration practice. And just very kind of lovingly, for example, just go with your breath. Kind of concentrate on the breath. Kind of softly hang on to the in-breath, the out-breath, the in-breath, the out-breath. Maybe breathe a little bit deeper than you normally do if you're really agitated. Take some deep breaths and just hang on. And with time, if you do that for 5 or 10 minutes, with time that'll tend, to bring some calm into the situation, to calm the energy down, to bring some balance back in. If you find that you have if you're too slothful, or there's not enough energy, you're kind of drowsy or dull, or there's no sharpness to your attention when you sit to meditate, then maybe you have too much tranquility or too much concentration or too much calm. It's interesting, in Buddhism, these three things, calm, tranquility, and concentration, are almost treated as synonyms. If you have too much of those, either that, then you get tired, or or you don't have the sharpness of attention, alertness. And then you want to balance that by bringing more energy into the practice. So if you sit down, sometimes you find at some point in your sitting that you're drowsy or dull, or then you can bring more energy, sometimes by sitting up straighter, by bringing energy in your posture, or brightening your mind, brightening the knowing quality. I don't know how to explain that better than that, but you kind of brighten that up, or kind of bring some energy to knowing, kind of look more carefully, be more alert to what's going on. Jack Kornfield, I spent a time when he was a monk, being extremely sleepy in meditation. He kept falling asleep like this. People fall asleep in meditation, they sometimes will, the torso will drop forward and catch themselves. I've been known to do that once or twice. Maybe. And so his teacher told him to go and meditate. So he needed more energy. He needed more kind of, a little bit more, energy in his practice. So his teacher had him sit on the edge of a well. So then he didn't fall asleep anymore. So I don't recommend that, but find you know, more gentle ways of bringing more energy. And sometimes you can notice sometimes if faith is understanding are imbalanced. Sometimes if there's too much inspiration, and it can be kind of blind, it can be a real letdown for spiritual practice. And you can feel kind of waves of great hope and inspiration for it's going to save me, it's going to do it for me, and then it doesn't do it for you, and oh my God, it's just terrible. You enter kind of a dark hole for a while, and you read the next book, or oh yes, that's going to do it. And if you realize that kind of trend, you might say, well, I need to kind of balance that with some understanding, with some wisdom. And so, what is the wisdom that balances blind faith or blind hope? And there's many things that could be said, but one of the things is to really understand that in the teachings of Buddhism, the place where hope resides, the place where real spiritual transformation resides, is not in something outside, but is in our own ability to turn the mirror of attention back and really understand where the seat of our suffering and the seat of our freedom really resides in ourselves. So that the citta, so that this heartfelt, the heart of presence within us becomes liberated. The liberated heart, the liberated citta is what we're looking for in Buddhism. The liberated mind heart. That ability to be present in life, fully present for what's happening, lovingly present for what's happening, but not sucked into it and not aloof from it, but just balanced within it. So those are the five faculties. Any comments or questions about that? That seem relevant to your own practice? Maybe? That was my hope. Any questions? Concerning anything? Yes.
In regards to Vipassana as opposed to other meditation techniques, and I'm curious as to, this style is that style, as to, what's the point of having so many styles
of meditation?
Meditation, right. I mean, is there some kind of meta experience that you're supposed to be having beyond, each style.
So many styles of Buddhist meditation,
or
just in general.
Just, Yeah, Buddhist meditation. It could be Buddhist meditation or just meditation in general. Some follow the breath, some have mantras.
Right, some visualizations.
Right.
Well, it gets more complicated because there's different styles of Vipassana practice, different schools of how this practice is taught. In Buddhism, there's a expression called skillful means, and so there are many skillful means. There are many tools that a person might use to help them understand themselves, so they can come free. And so depending on what a person feels they need, they can use the different tools. So Buddhism has a whole repertoire of actually different kinds of meditation practices. And so sometimes depending on... So loving-kindness meditation, a particular meditation practice on loving-kindness and kind of on the theme of love, is often done sometimes as an antidote when there's a lot of anger. And anger is maybe so strong that it's really hard to do a mindfulness practice because you keep getting lost in the anger. And then the person might do a loving kindness practice to cool out, kind of to bring some balance again. So there are a number of anecdotal practices depending on what a person needs. There's also specific concentration practices, and there's a lot of things that fit in there. There's visualizations, there's mantras, there's just staying very fixedly on the breath. And some people feel it's very useful to cultivate strong states of concentration, either for its own sake, because it's very pleasant, it actually can be very healing to get very deeply concentrated, because such great unification of mind and body, and such stillness and peace and calm that can come from concentration. Or as a kind of stepping stone to going further with the mindfulness practice. It's taught in Buddhism that only mindfulness will give you the ultimate freedom. But some people will start by doing a concentration practice so that there's a tremendous amount of concentration present when the person switches to doing mindfulness. Buddhism, yeah. So it's basically what I said. So I think pretty much most Buddhists will say that mindfulness is the practice you need to get liberated. But then the question is, do you want to use other practices as an aid? Or do you want to stick just with the mindfulness practice? And sometimes a student will decide to do other things, or sometimes in the consultation with the teacher might suggest different things. You should be doing more of a concentration practice, or you should do loving kindness practice.
Part of my reason for asking that is that I'm aware of different breath practices and different styles of meditation, rather than just following the breath, actually using the breath
right.
to kind of calm the mind.
Right. So
I find that as a real useful practice, but at the same time, I don't see that as being. I'm just wondering how that fits into this particular practice.
Well, one way it could fit in is you could do that initially, like if you sit for 40 minutes, you might do that for the first 20 minutes, if that helps you get really calm, and present and centered, and then a switch to mindfulness, and not. So if initially you're doing a particular, you're trying to change something, you're actually doing manipulating a situation. Mindfulness, there's no manipulation in mindfulness. In mindfulness, you're not trying to manipulate anything. You're not trying to change or adapt or get rid of anything or make anything happen. Mindfulness is just, it's like a mirror, which doesn't try to change anything. But if you do a concentration practice like what you're talking about, that's trying to change or manipulate the situation. So you might do that for 20 minutes and then switch.
I guess the source of my, I don't know if I can call it confusion or not, but is that, okay, what, I guess specifically I'm thinking about like pranayama or in yoga,
yeah.
or people who, you know, manipulate the breath, and I've read of people who are aware of every breath that they take, and
sure.
I'm just kind of like, that's pretty aware.
Well, you could you
sense if that's a way to this place, then you could just follow that just as easily as this or whatever.
Well, this depends. Yes, you can. I don't think it's that place, but it's this is where you get into religious theory. You know, different schools of Buddhism, or different schools of yoga, for example, have different ideas of what the point and the goal is for the practice. And depending on the kind of practice you do, you might actually end up a little bit different kind of end point. So you have to kind of study, or we can talk about it more sometime if you're interested in this. And mindfulness has a particular kind of, you know, has a kind of different endpoint in a sense than pranayama usually, I think, the way I understand it. Now, one of the reasons why, so in Buddhism, generally, religious practice in Buddhism, spiritual practices like meditation, don't have any ultimate value in and of themselves. Usually, they're just skillful means. So we don't get really dogmatic about saying, you know, this is the one way, the true way. It's just, this is a useful way. We found this way to be very useful for a lot of people. And but anytime you kind of offer one practice for everyone, you know, it's not going to suit everyone. So often then in consultation with a teacher, you might change it or do something different. But having said that, I find that the particular style of meditation that we do, the mindfulness practice, is I find incredibly beautiful and very profound and very wise. Because what it is, it's what we're learning to do is to cultivate a hospitality, a presence, an equanimity, an acceptance of things as they are, rather than finding our well-being by getting someplace special. So if you're in rush hour traffic, so if you sit here and we did...
I understand what you're saying, but my mind is saying that you're saying the same thing, only just kind of like flipping it around because you're getting to the same place. I hear that anyway. I don't know if that's what you're really saying.
Well, maybe, but see, mindfulness is not a place.
Right.
And
right.
So if you do a concentration practice, it can get you to the place where you are accepting, you're kind of present and kind of loving and open and calm and everything. But that's a particular state. That's a particular state. You get in rush hour traffic at 5 o'clock and you lose that state. Mindfulness itself is not exactly a state. It's a kind of a function or capacity that can bring acceptance to even the rush hour traffic, even when you start kind of, you know, things get kind of, you know, trying around you. Or when you do get tense, for example, or you have to, can it be okay in a sense to be tense? Can you find some equanimity to being tense? Or is there subtle aversion or gross aversion to being tense or judgment about it and say, well, I better get to some better state. Okay, I'm going to do my mantra. You know. So there's a kind of subtle turning away and getting rid of some state. Whereas mindfulness is actually subtly moving into what's actually happening. And in the midst of what's actually happening, finding the acceptance there. Come what may. Not, let me see if I can get calm, and then I can accept, you know, everyone as they are. So part of the profundity that I like this kind of practice, the way we teach it here, it doesn't require us to get anywhere. It requires us simply to be where we already are, and then to find the acceptance and equanimity, the balance, the acceptance. I like the word acceptance a lot, of what's actually here. Now, if we do this with energy, with engagement, with faith, with mindfulness, with concentration, and sustaining it, then there is change that happens. And some people are looking for change to happen, stronger mindfulness, stronger freedom. However, I like to look at this practice as the means and the ends are the same. The end of this practice is to be mindful of what's happening in the present. And the means to do that is to be mindful of what's happening in the present. So there's nowhere to get. Now, some people might say, well, that's kind of silly and it's kind of superficial and not so profound. My understanding of the vision of spiritual practice that comes through enlightened eyes is just that, is that the means and the ends of practice are the same thing. So part of the profundity of offering the practice this way is it's offering the practice as if you're already enlightened. But if you don't like that idea, that's fine, because you can do it just the way we're doing it anyway, and do it well enough and you'll get enlightened. Something like that. Also, one of the great sources of suffering for many of us is this gross or subtle kind of idea that we're responsible and in charge. And when we do a practice where we're taking charge and making change happen, it reinforces the idea that we're the agent of change. And we are, some degree. You know, it's not like Buddhism saying you can't be responsible. But there's something more profound, kind of trust in life, that happens when we do a practice that doesn't require us to be the agent causing the change. And so that's why I don't teach particularly concentration kind of practices. I try not to teach the mindfulness practice too much from the point of view that you have to do this so you can make a change. Rather, you do this so change happens to you. So we're getting a little bit into theology now. Yes.
You know, I could be wrong, but for me, a lot of this practice is about just heightening my own sense of instinctual awareness. This whole time you've been talking, I've been remembering, you know, when I moved over to Europe and, you know, finding a place and being on my own and speaking a language and learning more of the language and trying to get home and being by myself and being so completely isolated in all of this. And how I found this practice was in the nights when I would finally find myself in a safe place, you know, home, I was finally settled in. I would just like listen to everything. That's why the other night I said I think I tune in more with listening. And that I kind of equate it with like how we see animals actually always being very aware and very present. And it's much harder, I think, for people in today's world to be that way. So I kind of equate it almost with that sense of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And as we become stronger, it isn't something we simply do when we find a safe place. We learn how to do that in difficult situations also, to have that freedom of awareness so that we don't get sticky.
Yeah. Yeah.
So last one. Yeah.
I'm a little puzzled about the word antidote that you used earlier. Uh-huh. I'm trying to understand why it didn't work. Go to a teacher and say, this isn't working for me, or I'm not where I want to be, if the process is what it's about.
Oh,
and then why would you be given an antidote to move out of whatever you were experiencing?
Rather than getting to know it better.
If there isn't right and wrong about it, or not a place to be.
Well, there's maybe two answers. One is, sometimes certain emotional states or states of being are too overwhelming for people. And people keep getting sucked into them and kind of spiraling downwards. So they're going to be angry rage or full of fear or something. And the person can't actually see what's going on in the present moment because the emotion is kind of taking over in a sense. And then, you know, and actually to bring more mindfulness situation can sometimes actually make things worse because we become more self-conscious and kind of add fuels to the fire. And then sometimes in that kind of extreme situation, then it can actually be not even useful to do mindfulness, but rather what's useful because of strong habits of mind to be angry or whatever, but rather to do something else which helps cool the mind, and so that it brings some balance to it. So antidote is kind of like the opposite that brings balance. So in our particular scene, that's usually when antidote is offered, when it really needs to be offered as a balance. The person's really imbalanced in some way, and the mindfulness just can't. You know, in a sense, work. In other schools of Buddhism, they think this way all the time. They think, oh, the antidote. So they're constantly kind of thinking, okay, there's anger, so let's do loving kindness. Now there's agitation, let's do some concentration practice. And they're constantly kind of balancing themselves and finding their way forward until they kind of, you know, find a great stability of presence. And that's just a different way of doing it. But from what I was saying earlier, I believe there's something more profound to be discovered when we learn how to really face what's happening directly, rather than getting really skillful at finding kind of all the balancing that gets us to some place of great calm. But that's a little bit of an opinion. It's religious opinion, what I'm offering you. And other people have different religious opinions. So don't take my opinion too seriously. That's my opinion.
Well, it might be that if I'm experiencing just stuck place, I'm just, you know, like a stuck record,
uh-huh.
and I can't get out of that place, then you might offer me a
Right. I might either offer you a balance practice, or I might talk with you and find out where the stuckness is, and help you to show you how to bring mindfulness more carefully to it. Because often there's some key to what needs attention, which a person hasn't noticed yet. So one of the functions of a teacher is to kind of help you find that thing you need to be aware of, so that you're not stuck so much anymore.
How long should you be stuck?
So let's stay stuck for 2 minutes. We'll do a 2 minute sit. As you sit, what would it be like to sit as if you profoundly trusted yourself, trusted your ability to be open and present? And if you allow the energy, the effort to stay present, to arise out of that trust, and for that energy to manifest itself in a very simple way, knowing what's happening in the present moment, recognizing what's happening. And then maintaining continuity through time of this simple recognition, simple presence of what's happening now and now and now. Letting yourself penetrate more insightfully, more deeply, into what is actually happening now. Faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Thank you all. Good night.